From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. President Barack Obama made the rounds this week, visiting with Republican lawmakers and corporate CEOs. The president is pulling out all the stops in an effort to gain bipartisan support for his economic recovery package. And the Senate Judiciary Committee approves Eric Holder's nomination for Attorney General. Will Holder be easily approved in the Senate? Here with their views on the latest political news are Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert Trainum, the D.C. bureau chief for Comcast Network, host of Roll Call TV, and a professor at George Washington University. Hello, both of you.
Hey, Tony.
Hey, Tony.
Hey, listen, let's talk about President Obama. He met with business CEOs today in an effort to drum up support for his economic plan. Afterward, he spoke about how well that meeting went.
Corporate America will have to accept its own responsibilities to its workers and the American public. But these executives also understand that without wise leadership in Washington, even the best-run businesses can't do as well as they might. They understand that what makes an idea sound is not whether it's Democrat or Republican, but whether it makes good economic sense for their workers and companies.
Mary, he is working every angle, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely, and he's right to work every angle because this is a huge stimulus package and nobody knows whether it's going to work or not. We hope it will. And at the same time, it does have things in it that are considered flaws that are attacked by the Republicans. He's got enough Democratic votes, even though some Democrats are a little worried about it, to get it passed, but in fact, he wants to get as much of a consensus as possible so that everybody in the country is on board, so that it becomes everybody's stimulus and not just his in terms of how it turns out. And that's smart.
You know, the president has been meeting with legislators on Capitol Hill, as we all know. House Republican leader John Boehner says his GOP colleagues enjoyed yesterday's conversation with the president. Representative Mike Pence said they were grateful for the dialogue with Obama. Some said he was a great salesman but had a lousy product, namely the stimulus. So, Robert, this is test number one for the new president, and it's not clear to me how well he is going to do, even if he gets it passed on Democratic support only.
You're exactly right, Tony. Look, the president recognizes that failure is not an option. This economy is way too complex, and the problem is way too severe for anyone to fail. And what he's trying to do, and I would make the argument from a political standpoint, he's doing it brilliantly, is he's trying to make sure that everyone's fingerprints are on this stimulus package so that, A, he can say to the American people that we're all in this together, but also, B, that if, in fact, it does fail, he can say, at least we try, but everyone is to blame, not just him. Remember, Tony, this man is up for re-election 4 years in 2012, and the White House is already thinking about how to position him in 2012, regardless of who the Republican nominee is going to be. The American people have always voted by their pocketbooks, and if the economy is humming along, I would suspect and predict that the president would get re-elected. But if it's not, expect the president to go down in defeat.
Well, Mary, you know, there is, of course, as we've said, no unanimity in Congress on the stimulus package. But I'm curious about this, and I'd like to get your response. It seems to me that there is a gap in ideology between House Republicans and Senate Republicans. Now, if you agree, to what do you attribute that? Because are GOP senators more willing to go along with the plan than their House counterparts?
Well, there is disunity on the Republican side between the House and the Senate because senators, of course, represent whole states. That's one thing. And depending on what's going on across the state economically, they would be more inclined to be in favor of something than House members who represent districts. And it depends a lot on who the people are in their districts. There's another point. The House seems to have not taken a bipartisan approach to developing the legislation, which has left the House open to criticism. Speaker Pelosi famously said that, yes, we won the election and we wrote the bill, which gave them something on the Republican side to jump on, the lack of bipartisanship. Whereas on the Senate side, the senators in charge of the committee seem to have been talking to the Republicans, crafting legislation together. But the Senate has different traditions and different approaches. Also, the margin in the House is much larger than it is in the Senate for the Democrats. They can win without them, and the Republicans in the Senate still have the ability to filibuster, whether they would or not. So they have more leverage than the Republicans in the House.
Well, you know, Robert, John Boehner seemed to soften his position, and as the leader in the House, he's not able to get his guys to go along with him, it appears.
Yeah, well, you know, John Boehner has a very difficult problem. One is because he recognizes that as a member of the House, the majority rules. That's how the rules are set up, as Mary mentioned or alluded to in reference to the Senate. The Senate obviously is a little bit different because the minority also rules as well. And so what Boehner needs to do is he needs to keep his rank and file in check, but he also needs to keep his pulse to the American people. The American people right now are hurting, and they want their elected officials to do something. So he has two constituencies, is what I'm trying to say, Tony. One, his rank and file House members, who represent very interesting and diverse districts, but also to the American people. According to the latest poll, 69% say, you know what, we want some type of economic stimulus package, but what we don't want is $20 million going to Planned Parenthood or, you know, $2 billion going to Acorn. We want this money to go into the American economy, so thus in the process, the ball keeps rolling.
And the Democrats have been sensitive to this poll business. They dropped the money going to family planning. They also dropped the item going to fix up the mall when the Republicans seized the National Mall when the Republicans seized on that. So everybody's sensitive to how these things are playing out with the public.
Let's move on to this topic. The Senate Judiciary Committee voting to approve Attorney General nominee Eric Holder. Now, today's vote comes after Senate Republicans had forced a one-week delay. At issue was whether Holder would attempt to prosecute intelligence agents who authorized controversial interrogation tactics like waterboarding, something Holder has testified that he believes is torture. So there were a couple of holdouts, Mary, on the committee who voted against Holder over the issue of these possible future prosecutions. But the committee support overall seems to signal that this won't be an issue of major consequence for Holder against the whole Senate. Is that right?
No, he will likely get confirmed in a matter of days. Eric Holder will. He's superbly qualified. And Senator Specter has been trying to touch him up around the ears a little bit. The strategy with Eric Holder was to have the Republicans beat up on him in sort of a revenge for what happened to Gonzalez and Alberto Gonzalez, and then to go ahead and confirm him. No one has in mind not confirming him. And then there were a couple of senators who were concerned about whether they're going to prosecute anybody for using these interrogation techniques and wanted to get some kind of firm commitment on that. But it's a delay, but Obama has already started naming the people who will be the assistant attorney generals and jobs below Eric Holder, and he'll be confirmed in a matter of days.
Let's talk about this potential prosecution issue a little bit more, Robert. Do you think that Obama would pursue prosecutions against former Bush administration officials if it could be proven that they committed serious violations of the law, even if Obama's Justice Department doesn't go looking for anybody on their own?
I don't think so. I think intuitively the president wants just to move the ball forward and not look back. I think his supporters, though, particularly MoveOn.org, maybe Nancy Pelosi and the more left wing of the Democratic Party, wants the president to do that. But, you know, this president is a little bit different. He's showing us through his cabinet appointments, Tony, through his public statements and his overall disposition, that he wants to govern as a moderate. And the last thing that you want to do is go to the extreme left and alienate the people out there that voted for you, i.e. these Obama Republicans and these moderate Democrats and these Reagan Democrats, whatever you want to call them. So, no, to answer your question, I don't think that's going to happen, although I do think there's going to be a lot of chatter. I think this is going to probably stir up in the blogs, and then particularly with Obama's hard left supporters, but I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Well, there are people who are not even hard left, I mean, who think that there ought to be some prosecutions. In fact, you can argue that if government officials spend 8 years in office and do things that are in violation of the law and no one does anything about it ever, that just means that the next administration can do whatever they want, and no one will ever say anything about it. Once it's over, and it stays. So there are arguments, on the other hand, for pursuing some of these things, but I agree with Robert that Obama has already made clear that he's not interested in pursuing them.
Well, you know, this thought came to me, Mary, and I thought of you, actually. Is this situation with Bush and Guantanamo et al. Similar to 30 years ago, let's go back, you and I, when then-President Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon because, as he said at the time, the nation needed to heal from the wounds of Watergate and move forward?
Well, that's what Obama is essentially saying. Whatever happened happened, and whatever legal opinions were out there, which he has already disavowed, which gave cover to the things that happened, and whatever cover-ups took place, that the country doesn't need to be bogged down in discussing those, and we should just move on. It's the same thing. Some people think that Gerald Ford paid a price for that in the election that took place after that when Jimmy Carter beat him. I don't think Obama's going to pay any price for this. There'll be some grousing and some complaining and some efforts by members of Congress even in the Judiciary Committee to do something. But I don't think anything will happen, and I don't think there will be any retribution for him.
Well, the abyss politically that we were in the 70s is not comparable to where we are now, unless you're talking about the financial abyss that we are in, which is worse than the one that we were in in the 70s. Mary Robert, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Tony.
That was Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert Trainum, the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast Network, CNH, host of Roll Call TV, and a professor at George Washington University. They both joined us from Washington, D.C. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. First Lady Michelle Obama is catching heat from some black designers over her inauguration fashion choices. It's the latest topic catching attention on our blog, News and Views, and Jeffrey Bennett is here to tell us about it. Jeffrey is the digital producer for News and Notes. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tony.
So the honeymoon, fashion-wise, let's say, is over for Michelle Obama. Tell us about the criticism that she's getting and the response on our blog.
Well, the co-founder of a group called the Black Artist Association said in an interview with Women's Wear Daily that Michelle Obama was wrong for not choosing to wear designs by black designers. And she says, quote, "It's fine and good if you want to be all kumbaya and we are the world by representing all different countries. It's one thing to look at the world without color, but she had 7 slots to wear designer clothes. Why wasn't she wearing the clothes of a black designer? That was our moment," end quote. And Tammy Woodward, one of our News and Notes listeners, said, "Mrs. Obama looked wonderful, and I personally never cared who made them. Honestly, don't the Obamas have more than enough to worry about besides the ethnicity of clothing designers?" And Leslie Sarag wrote this, "The Obama presidency is in many ways a culmination of the civil rights struggles of the 60s, in which blacks and whites, Jews and Christians, young and old participated. I like it that the Obamas are not narrowing that field, but rather broadening it."
People are definitely having their opinions, aren't they? Monday's Bloggers Roundtable is getting some attention online as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, more on the issue of Obama. You can't get enough of the Obamas around here, apparently. It was a conversation about a study that purported to show President Obama's presence in the White House having a positive effect on black students' achievement and academic achievement. And blogger Chris Rabb of Afronetizen said this.
"I previously had promoted learning and books and like veteran teachers to teach our children. But now I think if they see a black president, we don't need to invest in education anymore. They can just have a poster of a black person in the classroom, and that probably will, you know, resolve the whole educational disparities in our country. It's fascinating."
So in response on our website, Beth Martinez, one of our listeners, wrote, "Chris Rabb from Afronetizen is the voice of reason on this bogus study result. The key to academic success is hard work and parental involvement." And Jerry Blackwell says, "It's not enough to look at Obama's skin color and features and say, because I can see some black African features, I too can do what he did."
Well, on our show, we've also been warning our listeners about the coming digital television conversion. There's been some action on that just today.
There has. It appears as if the delay that the Obama administration wanted will not happen. The switch from analog to digital TV takes place on February 17th. So anyone who has a TV that uses an antenna or rabbit ears or whatever to get a signal runs the risk of going dark if they hadn't by now purchased a converter box. And the reason for that delay was because the reason the Obama administration wanted the delay was because the government fund that was distributing vouchers to offset the cost of those boxes has run out of money.
It's a mess, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's confusing. Well, I have both, actually, at my house, satellite and rabbit ears. So I have to get that box to get my rabbit ear
TV
to work.
So the ESPN will not be going dark.
No, it will not. Thank you very much, Jeffrey. Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes. He joined me here in the studios of NPR West. Now on to our bloggers roundtable. More on the controversy over Michelle Obama's inaugural wardrobe. Plus, President Barack Obama sits down with an Arab TV network and Senator Oprah. With us, Brandon Whitney of the blog Homeland Colors. He also writes about politics for the websites Black Men in America and My Voice DC. Felicia Harvey, editor of Black Politics on the Web, and former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross. He blogs over at Three Brothers and a Sister and hosts The Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio. Hello, everybody.
How you doing? Hello there, Tony.
Hello. I'm fine. Let's talk about Michelle just a little bit more because I'd like to get some thoughts from you that you're in the room with me, Kevin, and those of you and the other bloggers who we have on the air today. The dress she wore, as we all know, was designed by an Asian American. Kevin, is this much ado about nothing, really, or is there something to this?
Oh, no, this is a huge issue. And what became very clear to me over the last 48 hours was that what these black designers really are saying is that we didn't like what you had on. And the last thing that we want to see is this black woman. We want to see your hair done or your head did. Like at the DNC, when we saw Michelle Obama's hair, that hair was flawless. It looked great. And the color that she picked, these black designers are saying, we are not impressed with Jason Wu. We're not necessarily impressed with Isabel Toledo. Because if you look at someone like a Halle Berry, no one has ever said, why doesn't Halle Berry wear black designers? Because people look at her and say, she's flawless. When she won for the Academy Award for Best Actress, that wasn't an issue. Black designers aren't happy with how Michelle looked. And they're saying, well, heck, if you're going to let anyone design you, let us, because, sister, we got your back, and we will have you looking incredible. Yeah. That's what this issue is.
Yeah, but Felicia, I mean, is a woman going to have to put up with this every time she walks out of the White House with something
on? Absolutely. For the next 4 years, we're going to hear criticism about her hair, about her clothes, all manner of insignificant things. We're going to hear it. And to address the initial issue, I don't think it was really about the fact that they didn't like the way she was dressed. I think they were thinking, okay, we got a black first family. It's our time to shine, too. We want to be one of those seven designers. And so I, to answer your earlier question, I do think it's much ado about nothing. She's not going to roam around naked for the next 4 years. So there'll be plenty of other opportunities for her to showcase different designers.
I'm surprised that Felicia would say that, because if anything, if you look at some of the comments, I went to Michelle Obama Watch online, 150 comments, and most of them are black women. I thought she looked incredible. But when I started reading what other black women were saying, they were like, that looked like a chenille.
Oh, no doubt.
Spread.
And so that's
what I started going, you know what? Black women are like, look, you are representing us. We want you to look, quote unquote, fierce. And we didn't
see
it.
You're correct.
So that was their complaint. So give black folks a chance
to show what we can do.
Jump in here, Brandon.
Yeah, I don't really think it had anything to do with the dress, to be honest with you. I mean, she wasn't saying, I wish Michelle had worn a black dress because I didn't like the dress she was wearing. I think it had more to do with this kind of tribalism that's developed in our own community, because we have an African-American president. We're expecting to get all of these hookups.
That's
not the case.
Point.
We didn't elect them by ourselves. There are 40 million black people. All of us can't vote. We're not of age to vote. Everybody in the country elected him. He's the country's president. He's the president of the United States.
But we can
cannot expect them to do to take care of every little thing. And to be honest with you, the fact that Barack Obama, if he had been born 200 years ago, wouldn't have been able to be anywhere near the White House unless he was cleaning it up.
But here's
the bigger
issue.
First, to focus on a dress.
All right, but let me stop you there, because I can see this is a hot topic, and I know it's burning up the blogosphere.
We haven't even touched the surface.
And we've been talking about it actually all week on News and Notes, but I don't want to spend the entire time on that, because there's something else that is also important that I'd like to get your views on as bloggers, and it has to do with this. The president went on Arabic cable television this week and spoke to the Muslim world. He said that he will work to show the Muslims that Americans are not their enemy. Here's what he said.
If countries like Iran are willing to unclench their fist, they will find an extended hand from us.
Now, President Obama also said that now is a time to broker lasting peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Let's hear him again.
The bottom line in all these talks and all these conversations is a child in the Palestinian territories going to be better off? Do they have a future for themselves? And is the child in Israel going to feel confident about his or her safety and security?
All right, so Kevin, here's why I want to come to you on this. This isn't as big a topic in the blogosphere or in black communities as Michelle Obama's clothes. Why is that?
Because this is about jobs and an economy, and people are scared. And let's face it, at the end of the day, as much as we're looking at what's going on with the Palestinians and the Israelis, we've got folks who are saying, I don't have a job. You've got individuals, these black individuals who are the designers, these are small business owners. These are folks who are saying, look, I've got staff, I've got employee, I've got overhead brick and mortar. And if we're looking at money, and we can see how by Sasha and Malia wearing J. Crew, J. Crew's website crashes, then that's saying that J. Crew is making money off of them. When you look at these designers, has an African-American designed any First Lady's dress? Did they design Laura Bush or Mama Bush or Jackie O? So they're saying in this whole line, why would that be any different than, let's say, someone looking at in Los Angeles, for instance? There are 46 talk show hosts, yeah, and not one of them in the Los Angeles area are Native American, Asian, Latino, or black. So this is really about how do people of color get opportunities?
But on the other, the person who designed the dress was a person of color.
On the other hand,
Brandon,
I want to bring you into this because this issue of the Middle East definitely impacts people in black America because they are going to Iraq, they're going to Afghanistan, they're going to Pakistan, they're losing their lives. So whether or not the president is able to establish a new relationship in the Muslim world is certainly something that is worthy of our attention. Is it not,
Brandon? It definitely is. It's way more important. I think Obama right now, if you listen to that interview and you listen to the words he says and the way he communicates to the Middle East and the Muslim world, he's working on being the best foreign policy president ever. And we're focused on addressing the African-American community because sometimes we can be completely myopic and we only think about how everything affects us directly. Not remembering basically that thousands of people were killed in Gaza. So while we're focused on a dress that Michelle Obama wore on what should have been a very happy day, save for these people who are focused on minutia, people are dying in the Middle East. People who could be crashing planes into buildings or who could be our friends. These are the choices they have. And Barack is trying to make sure they're our friends, and we're focused on a dress. Well, I think that says a lot about the quality of understanding that we have sometimes of the world as a people.
Felicia, what do you say?
I would say that everything we're discussing in terms of our focus on Michelle's dress and a lot of the other issues that are kind of fluff just shows why his overtures were so significant. Because most people are thinking, not necessarily about her dress, but about the fact that they don't have a job or they're worried about losing their job or all the different economic issues that are going on. So for him to basically extend a hand and kind of show that the winds of change in Washington have arrived, that makes it very significant. I do think that at times we tend to focus on things that aren't as important, like Michelle's dress or whether Barack is black or biracial, multiracial, superracial, whatever. We do tend to kind of lose sight of those more important issues that are out there.
Do you think, Kevin, that this is going to make a change the way that Barack Obama initially reached out to the Muslim world?
Absolutely. And I think the reason that we're all looking to Barack and Michelle, because they're a matching set. It's not an either or. It's not as if Barack can't try to broker some sort of calm in the Middle East, and Michelle Obama can't be cognizant of the fact that we are talking about individuals who are at the precipice of losing everything. And I beg to differ. If you are someone in the fashion industry, and you know the millions and millions of dollars and jobs and revenues that are behind these industries, Barack, I mean, as we speak, people are knocking off Michelle Obama's dress, and they are using it to make money to stimulate this economy. The number one issue in this country right now is jobs. It is not the issue between the Palestinians and Israelis, if you ask the average person. And so when you say, well, this is fluff, if you're a designer and you're saying, I'm trying to stimulate this economy, Barack, Michelle's dress becomes a big deal.
All right, let's talk about something else that might be considered fluff. In fact, I will go so far as to say that it is fluff, but we talk about fluff on this show also.
No, not here.
Yes, we do, on occasion. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich has said publicly several times that he considered appointing Oprah Winfrey to the U.S. Senate seat vacated by the president, and apparently he wasn't joking.
It is true that among the many potential candidates for the Senate seat, we discussed Oprah. And it was an idea that a friend brought to me. My thought was an African-American woman who probably by herself has more influence than 100 senators. She was instrumental in electing Barack Obama president. She clearly could use her bully pulpit to do good things for people. The question was whether or not there was any chance at all she'd be willing to do it. And then if so, how do you reach out to her? Would she take the call of the governor of Illinois, for example, because Oprah's Oprah and I'm just the governor of Illinois?
So we found out from Oprah whether she would have taken that call. Here's what she told her friend Gail.
If I had been watching, as I know as I watch from the treadmill, I'd probably fallen off the treadmill. I'm pretty amused by the whole thing. Where would I fit it in with my day job, my midday job, my night job, my radio job, my magazine job?
Yes, you have 15 jobs, Mon. You have 15 jobs.
Yeah. I think I could be senator, too. I'm just not interested.
Oprah Winfrey, we have about a minute left, so we don't have enough time for everybody to weigh in fully on this. But I guess for Oprah, Felicia, to take that job, it would be a step down.
Amen. Absolutely. And the governor is a fool. I think he's pretty much all about the show. I couldn't even say if he honestly was considering her, if he just wanted a soundbite in the newspapers and on television.
Felicia, I beg to differ. That governor is brilliant. He knew exactly what he was doing. He is no dummy. And the fact of the matter is, why would Oprah want to be one of 100? I could see her being the governor and taking his job. But in terms of why he's even mentioning Oprah, he knows exactly what he's doing. And I say, you know what? It'll be interesting to see how this thing plays out.
I don't think he's brilliant. I think he's desperate. You know, you'll do anything if you're desperate enough.
Well, he might be both. You know?
I don't think it's an either or.
Thin line between genius and insanity.
All right, our time has run out. We have hit some very serious and some fluff subjects today, but it's been good as always. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Tony.
We have been talking with Brandon Whitney of the blog Homeland Colors. He also writes about politics for the websites Black Men in America and My Voice DC. He joined us from our headquarters in Washington. Felicia Harvey, editor of Black Politics on the Web. She was at member station WUSF in Tampa, Florida. And former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, who blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister. He was with me right here in our NPR West studios. Now, you can find links to their blogs and to ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop there. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues that you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. It is a parental dilemma of Shakespearean magnitude, to spank or not to spank. That is the question. Well, as with many things, the late comedian Bernie Mac made his opinion quite clear.
That's right, I said I'm gonna bust her head to the white meat show. And I ain't ashamed that I said it. Ain't nobody gonna make me take it back.
Well, maybe not, but another point of view we might be able to get right now from News and Notes regular contributor Judge Lynn Toler. She is an author and star of TV's Divorce Court. Hello, Lynn.
Hello, Tony. How are you?
Well, you heard what Bernie Mac had to say. You and I both know raising kids is not easy. There are times when they are perfect little angels, and then there are other times when they go just crazy. So, a very controversial question. A lot of people have opinions about it, but when do you think it's okay to, you know what, not when, where do you think it's okay to spank your child if you are a spanker?
My mother's favorite spot was the top of the thigh, especially when they're very young, and that was my spot when my children were very, very young. The bottom comes later, but not often, rare, memorable, but I did spank, and I do believe in it.
You know, when I was a kid, boys get hit upside the head a lot of time, the back of the head.
Right.
Don't do that with girls. So there's a difference between how you corporally punish boys and girls if you're going to do it, right?
I think absolutely true. I think boys and girls take it differently. Boys and girls look at physical aggression differently. And sometimes it's just easier with a guy, with boys, because I guess I, based upon my own experience, they get over stuff. Oh, this is bad. That hurts. And I get over it. And I've never raised girls, so I don't know. I had six boys, so I have a whole lot of information on one side of the hormone scale and very little on the other.
Well, I had both, and it's a tricky situation. But, you know, another where question, Judge Toler, isn't so much where on the body you might hit them, whether you spank them on the hand or their little legs or on the butt or whatever. Where in public, if anywhere, do you discipline your children with a spanking if they seem to need one?
I personally have never done it. I think it should be, all options should be available to you. And if you must do so, remove them from the complete public. If you are, you know, take them into a restroom or a bathroom or somewhere like that or out. But if it has to be done, and the younger they are, the quicker the offense and the spanking have to be. They have to be in greater proximity. Remove them as best you can from public. But if it is so outrageous and it's so needed to be done, I like to have all my options open.
Well, you know, we've certainly seen kids in places, in the supermarket, in the department store, at a ball game, acting out. And you wonder sometimes, as a parent, if it's appropriate, because in these times, there are a lot of people that just don't believe in spanking under any circumstances. And it gives you pause for a moment when you are confronted with a misbehaving child and you are in front of strangers, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And a lot of people don't believe in spanking anymore. And I think a lot of people don't believe in spanking because often when spanking is used, it is misused. You have to make sure to do it rare, effectively, but not because you're frustrated, upset, angry, embarrassed, or otherwise discomfited, or just because it's some small knicky-knack behavior. If you start to spank to resolve problems quickly and easily, but not using it as a last resort in, you know, as we call in our house, capital offenses, then that is abusive and it is not helpful. And often when you do see somebody, you know, going off on their kids in public, I often see it as a sign of frustration on the part of the parent as opposed to an acting out on a part of the child that requires a corporal response.
When is the time, the right time, the appropriate time, if there is such a thing, to stop spanking a child? Obviously, if your kid gets bigger than you, you want to think twice about it, I suppose. But when is the right time?
It depends on who your child is. My oldest one got spanked once in his entire life. The last one, he got his last spanking in the fifth grade. If you're spanking much past then, the message didn't get there, and there are other more effective ways to stop him. When you're two and don't want your kid to run in the street and he's impulsive, a quick pop is helpful to you. When he's in the fifth grade and he's mouthing off at the teacher, the best thing is take the Xbox, the PlayStation, all out of his room, TV, everything, shut him down. That's more effective than a pop because in the fifth grade, he doesn't much care.
You know, is there ever a situation, Lynn, where for people who do not spank, that if they choose to discipline verbally, using profanity, using other kinds of emotional weaponry, is that as painful or as harmful as physical spanking?
I think it's worse. I think when you tell a child something, especially if you tell that child repeatedly, it goes into their soul and what it is and who I am and all about. When you spank, and if you do it appropriately, it's about the behavior. It's, Xavier, you can't run into the street. You go past the sidewalk and it will hurt. I can't explain to you about the car and the accident because you're two and you won't get it. But you will know past the sidewalk, pain is immediate, and that's what it is. So it's better, the words to me, when you, that's what people, that's what they really remember. Unless you're beating them every day. You know what I mean? You're beating them every day. That's another problem. That's abuse of another sort. But those words help define you. The appropriate and the occasional pop defines the act.
Let me end the conversation with this because it's fascinating. And we have a lot of single parent families in our country now, but we also have families where there are the mother and father or whatever the parental situation is, two in the household. How do you divide up the responsibility of disciplining and deciding who is the one that should do the spanking and who doesn't have to do it?
I think you have to work with whoever your kids are. In our house, it was mom gets to you first. And if she can solve it, that's fine. If it's really bad, we call in pops. That's how my husband did it. I used to didn't believe in spanking when I was young. And then when I was a young mother and I saw the error of my ways when my second one was born. But as they get older, the men have to take, I think, a greater responsibility. Now in my house where I am the smallest one, my children are bigger than me, I'm saying, like, look, you deal with me. And they've got that teenage, I want to be alpha dog thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
My husband reminds them, I am alpha dog. And to the extent you're messing with your mother, you're messing with me because that's my wife. So if, you know what I mean?
Yes,
and
I do.
And it's more of a, I am man, this is my crib, and she's my wife, and I am alpha dog. To get them through to 20,
absolutely,
when they can think again.
Absolutely. As Bernie Mac might say, they better recognize. Okay.
There you go.
Jeslyn Toler is an author and the star of TV's Divorce Court, speaking to us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Thanks, Lynn. Just a couple of weeks ago, we looked into the future of African-American publishing, but when it comes to buying books, it's hard to choose just one. Well, a new collection of writings by African-American authors and essayists has just been released, which could solve your book-buying dilemmas. Professor Gerald Early is the editor of Best African-American Fiction and Best African-American Essays, and he joins us now at News and Notes. Welcome, Gerald.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, the books were released on Inauguration Day. I don't know if that was significant or not. Tell us if it was and what inspired these collections.
Well, these collections I have been thinking about for a long time. I have been talking about it with my agent for some time about doing something like this. The big fear was that no publisher would be that interested in it because they wouldn't think that the collection could be sustained over a period of time doing it every year. But Bantam believed it, and so Bantam. We ultimately made a deal with Bantam to do it. The date wasn't really significant. I mean, the date turned out to be significant, but we had set the date a long time before, and we were just hoping that Obama would win, so the date would really have some significance. But it was all an accident. It turned out well, though.
Now, we've had anthologies before, obviously, but the new thing about this anthology is that you're going to try to publish it annually. How difficult do you think that is likely to be?
I don't really think it's going to be that difficult. I really do think there is enough quality African-American writing being generated that it could sustain this series without too much of a problem. We in the fiction volume, for instance, we not only do short stories, but we also publish excerpts from noted novels that have come out during the period that the book is covering. And with the essays, it's very broad where we search to find good writing, blogs and other kinds of places. And so when you really scour the field, there's a lot of good writing out there. I was surprised when we did these volumes how much good writing is out there.
You know, you talk about in the introduction to the essays book that we write, black people write nonfiction, but there's a question as to whether we read nonfiction or fiction more, is there?
Well, I would tend to think that there are periods of time when black people would read more nonfiction than fiction. Right about now, I think fiction may actually be more popular than nonfiction. Generally speaking, women read more fiction than men, and women, certainly black women, would read more fiction than black men would read. But on the whole, I think right about now, fiction would be more popular. We discovered with the essay writing that because of Obama's campaign and everything, he generated a lot. He was himself a subject of a great deal of writing among African Americans. And not only he himself, but also a lot with politics more generally because of his campaign.
Now, let's talk about the essay collection, as a matter of fact, because you have works there by people like Walter Mosley, Michael Eric Dyson. I even spotted an essay by the president himself. But what topics are primarily covered in these essays, if there is such a thing as a primary topic?
Well, the guest editor for the volume, and each year the volumes will have a guest editor, Deborah Dickerson, decided to lay out the book and categorize the essays. So there's a section on activism and political thought, which is a pretty large section. There's a section that deals with gay African Americans. There's a section on international. There's a section dealing with sports and entertainment, a section on friends and family and the like. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that every year it will be broken up in this way. As the guest editor, she had the right to classify the essays as she wanted to, and this is how she wanted to do it. The guest editor for the upcoming volume of 2010 is Randall Kennedy, and he may have an entirely different scheme. But the criteria was always that the essays just had to be good, interesting, lively, something that people would want to read, and that was somehow taken together would give people a sort of snapshot of what black people were thinking at the particular point that the book was published.
You know, it's very interesting you should mention that, because the book the American Essays book begins with the chapters on friends and family. And the very first essay written by Emily Bernard is one called Fired, Can a Friendship Really End for No Good Reason? I read this with the great interest because this is something that I would think could touch an awful lot of people.
Yeah, it was a very it's a very powerful essay about having, you know, she has this friend and, you know, the friendship just kind of falls apart. And it's perplexing as to exactly what happened with this friendship. And it's a friendship between a black person and a white person. And so she's going back and forth about her thinking about what happened with this friendship. Yeah, I would think that that would be something that would strike a lot of readers. One of the reasons we arranged the book in this way was that we wanted to start out with some essays that were sort of personal and would kind of hook the reader into the volume.
Something else that you've done, that you wrote in your introduction, which caught my eye, you put in a definition. Actually, you called it a point of clarification. What is an African American? And I thought that was curious, why you felt the need to explain what an African American is.
Well, I thought that people might ask, might want to know, you know, like, what do you mean by African-American? What is that? Well, you know, Deborah Dickerson, when she did the essays and she turned in her manuscript to me with the essay, she told me at the time, she said, I don't even know if all these people are black. And it actually turned out that some of the people aren't black. And she said, I just like these essays. And, you know, I just thought they were really discussing some really interesting and powerful stuff. I just wanted to make clear that insofar as what we're doing with this volume, we're being as elastic as possible in defining African American. So it meant anyone who's writing in English and who published something that was published in the United States that has any kind of African background or Caribbean background or anything, any kind of diaspora background. And Deborah was open to saying, well, you know, there were a couple of essays by people who weren't African-American I wanted to include that I thought were important. Doesn't necessarily mean that every guest editor will feel that way, but it was certainly fine with me that she did, and we included those essays.
Well, it certainly was fine with you, because I'm reading from your book here. This is what you said about non-African-American writers. Quote, I have learned over the years as much about African-American life from non-African-American writers as I have from African-Americans. That's interesting.
Yeah, I've read some very important books. I mean, there have been some very important scholars, you know, in my field, which I deal with African-American studies. There have been some very important non-African-Americans who have written in that field and who've done tremendous pioneering work in that field and who were important. And I've learned a great deal from them as a result. I feel no reason to discriminate against them in any way. I remember that John Hope Franklin once told me that in the South, African-American colleges, he said, were these what he called were integrated. So he called them these islands of civility. I like to think of the volumes that we're putting out as sort of islands of civility where, you know, lots of people can, you know, be shoulder to shoulder.
Gerald Early, thank you very much. Good luck with this project.
Thank you very much.
Gerald Early is the editor of Best African American Fiction and Best African American Essays. He is also a professor of English and African American Studies at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. He joined us from the studios of Washington University. That's our show for today. Glad you could join us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.